Welcome back to our election coverage. We're coming to you live from the Mary Winspear Center, Radio Sydney studio in downtown beautiful Sydney by the sea. I'm the host here, Bill Collins, with my co-host, Peter Wainwright, analyst extraordinaire. With this election coverage, we try to hit a few themes before we bombard you again with election results. In this one, with economic sovereignty has really dominated much of the campaign. We also know that Indigenous issues remain a critical part of Canada's political landscape. Peter, how are those concerns figuring into this election?
Well, Bill, Indigenous communities are watching closely, and they have their own set of issues, but particularly they're watching regarding the 2021 UNDRIP Act. It's nearly 4 years later, and there's still no action plan for implementation. And this is a clear dividing line between the parties.
How so?
Well, the Liberals promise to accelerate implementation with more funding, while the NDP want faster timelines with an Indigenous-led oversight. The Conservatives, however, are emphasizing what they call economic reconciliation, focusing on resource development, partnerships, while suggesting they might review or roll back parts of the Act.
While UNDRIP, beyond UNDRIP, what do you think becomes the immediate crises that Indigenous communities are facing?
Well, safe drinking water remains a major concern. Despite promises dating back to 2015, there's still 30 First Nation communities in Canada that are under long-term boil water advisories today. Some like Neskantanga in Northern Ontario for over 25 years.
So a generation without clean tap water. How are the parties addressing this?
Well, the Liberals point to 131 advisories that they've lifted while committing to finish the job. The NDP call it a human rights failure requiring an emergency response, and the Conservatives promise to prioritize these communities, but they're not offering any timelines or funding details.
So First Nations policing has also emerged as a significant issue, hasn't it?
Yes, particularly following the inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. There are strong calls to recognize First Nations policing as an essential service through legislation and with stable funding, rather than the current program-based approach, which many chiefs say is chronically underfunded.
What about food security in remote communities?
Okay, that is certainly an issue, and the statistics are alarming. Food insecurity affects about 48% of First Nation households, rising to over 75% in the more remote communities. And when basic staples cost three or four times what we pay in urban centers, many families simply can't afford adequate nutrition.
So what solutions are being proposed?
Well, the NDP and Liberals promise expansions to Nutrition North with better accountability, while Conservatives focus on more on transportation infrastructure like ice roads. Indigenous advocates argue that none of these fully address the need for food sovereignty and control over traditional harvesting territories.
The opioid crisis has certainly hit Indigenous communities particularly hard. What are we seeing on that front?
Well, death rates among First Nation peoples are three to five times higher than the general population. The NDP supports safe supply programs and harm reduction alongside treatment, explicitly acknowledging intergenerational trauma. The Liberals have a mixed approach, while Conservatives emphasize treatment and enforcement. But Indigenous health experts consistently call for culturally appropriate solutions incorporating traditional healing practices.
Interestingly enough, Peter, with the whole discussion of the Canada-US tariff issues and cross-border movement, is it particularly interesting for the First Nations communities under cross-border mobility, under the, I think it's the Jay Treaty of 1794?
Yeah, you're correct. So You know, the First Nations were here before there were national borders. And for nations like Mohawk of Akwesasne, whose territory spans Ontario, Quebec, and New York, and also for Coast Salish peoples in BC and Washington State, the border divides their traditional territories. And while the US recognizes these crossing rights, Canada has never fully implemented them. So, with increasing trade tensions, maintaining the rights to travel to the different parts of their territory and do trade is becoming more urgent.
Now, another issue that's been part of the landscape in Canada, housing affordability, but it takes on a unique dimension for Indigenous communities, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Housing on reserves is solely a federal responsibility and it's a fiduciary obligation, whereas elsewhere, it's a mix of federal, provincial, and local government jurisdictions. So it's, obviously very different. And there's a housing shortage of at least 85,000 units on reserves with severe overcrowding and inadequate conditions. Meanwhile, about 80% of Indigenous people live off reserve, facing both the general affordability challenges and discrimination in a rental market.
So, how do the parties address these specific housing challenges?
Well, the Liberals point to their distinction-based housing strategies and urban Indigenous housing plans. The NDP promises dedicated funding streams with greater First Nations autonomy and design, and the Conservatives focus more on market-based solutions and private sector partnerships. Indigenous advocates argue that none of these fully address the scale of investment that's required.
You know, despite touching on every aspect of this election, some of these issues have received little attention during the debates. I don't know what you say to that.
Well, unfortunately, that's been a pattern in Canadian elections. Indigenous voters represent a significant population, and they could swing quite a large number of ridings, yet their concerns often aren't, often get sidelined. Many Indigenous leaders are encouraging strategic voting based on specific commitments in these priorities.
Peter, I also note that I think I heard an interview with four chiefs probably 2, 3, 4 weeks ago where they were talking about similar issues and wanting a stronger voice in Canada-US discussions in general. We became a little interested in what's happening and maybe closer to home with one of the First Nations, Saanich Peninsula-based First Nations, the Tsartlip community. So a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with Adam Olson, who was the chairman of the Tsartlip Group of Companies. Bailey, can you please cue that clip? And we cannot hear the audio, Bailey.
We're now turning to a perspective that deserves more attention in our national discourse, and that's the crucial role of Indigenous economic development in building Canada's economic resilience. We're fortunate to have with us Adam Olson, who's the chair of the Tsartlip Group of Companies, who can provide insight into these issues and share his perspective on how federal policy affects their work.
Yeah, I started the conversation by asking Adam about the Tsartlip First Nation and the Tsartlip Group of Companies.
All right, so my name is Adam Olson. I am the board chair of Tsartlip Group of Companies and work for the Tsartlip First Nation, my home community here, just about 20 minutes north of Victoria, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island. Yeah, so we're working, we've got a fuel and convenience store, and we're looking to build businesses in a couple of different areas. I think that we are looking at some environmental services growth and some environmental services, as well as, I think the fuel and convenience business, there's some opportunities there for us for decades, this country has built an economy that has excluded Indigenous people, First Nations communities, Indigenous people across the country. And, you know, the exclusion has come at a cost. And we see the cost in our communities, the socioeconomic gaps, the infrastructure deficits that we experience within our own villages and within our own communities is dramatic and is a result of the exclusion from local, regional, and to the federal economy, the national economy. Part of the problem with exclusion, of course, is that we have not been able to build the pools of capital and liquidity that we need in order to be able to invest in businesses, to invest in that local economy, that national economy very easily. All of our programs and services in First Nations are federal and provincial programs and services, and they have very, very strict reporting requirements. It's not like we can take, you know, program funding that we get for, you know, for one of our departments and invest it in business. So, you know, it's the equivalent of trying to start up a business with nothing. And it's very, very difficult to do that. And of course, you know, the investment schemes that that other businesses would be attracted to, or that would help support those businesses getting started, may not be appropriate, because these are not just, we're not just creating a business. What we're looking to create is the engine for self-determination. There has been a lot of talk around what economic reconciliation looks like, and this has been, you know, largely a focus of, you know, partnering First Nations up with major projects that the government has prioritized that they would like to see happen. And that, you know, that really has been the limited view of what reconciliation means to some people in the political in the political landscape. I think that it's really important to recognize that reconciliation is a full package project. You can't just pull out, you know, the economic aspects of it and say, this is where we're going to focus reconciliation. Reconciling our past is a full project that requires a comprehensive view. The economic aspects of it are just one piece. And so, you know, I think that it's really important for us to be ensuring that when we hear the terms economic reconciliation, it sounds like that's going to, you know, be this solution for us, and, you know, that it's going to make all the rest of the problems go away. I think that what we need to be doing is saying, look, reconciliation is a project that requires social, environmental, and economic aspects to it, cultural aspects to it that we have to be paying close attention to. And we also have to be very supportive of the economic development potential that for First Nations so that we can meet those, fill the gaps that have existed, that exist today because of the systems that that have been built for us. The value of good relationships cannot be understated here, and I don't think that it actually can actually be quantified. But the reality is that we're just going to be in a much better place in this country when we've got equitable and just relationships and partnerships and business, and everybody's can be setting up to thrive together, rather than, like I said, there'd be this dramatic distinction between First Nations and non-First Nation communities.
Thanks. That was Adam Olson, part of the Sartlip group of companies. Adam talked to us last week. Now I've got a special guest, Barry Rooks, standing in. Some interesting riding results. Barry?
Yeah, we've been covering Terra Nova and the peninsulas and Newfoundland earlier today. The riding there has been going back and forth between Jonathan Rowe and Anthony Germain, who's the former CBC host there. After it's now sitting in with 268 of 270 polls reporting, Anthony Germain has just pulled into the lead with what's expected as being some early voting that's coming in later. He is sitting up by 14 votes at the moment. So very, very close riding. It's one of the few that have been going back and forth all night. And it looks like that's probably going to make its way to a recount as well. So that's a lot of stuff going on right now. Three polls to go there, but as close as you can get in Newfoundland, Labrador. I'll toss back to you, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. We're trying to locate Alan so that he can come in and give us a little bit of the Ontario perspective, maybe, or Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan. And before Alan comes on, perhaps, Peter, you've been tracking some interesting results here again in southern BC, lower mainland.
Yeah, just a couple of things have popped up. Globe and Mail has declared Saanich Gulf Islands for Elizabeth May. 95 polls reporting she's at 44%. Her nearest opponent's only at 26.5%. So they've called it on that basis. They've also called Mark Carney, winning his riding. We were tracking Abbotsford Langley South. That was Mike DeYoung. The independent, he did not take that riding. They've declared it for the conservative Suckman Gill at 43.1%. The liberal was next. DeYoung actually turned out well back.
Wow, cool. So some interesting results, obviously. Thanks for that. We're coming up now to 8:46 to the this part of this section. If you could, Bailey, we have some interesting information to play for you. That's a clip that was recorded earlier in the week. If you could cue up that clip, that would be great. Thanks, Bailey.
Yeah, so this is a clip from earlier. It's the overview of Skeena and the Bulkley Valley Federal Riding, and this is from Smithers, BC, CICK.
You're listening to CICK News Election Coverage 2025. This program is part of the Alt Election 2025 National Election Project, coordinated by the NCRA-ANREC. This initiative is supported by the Covering Canada Elections 2025 Fund in partnership with the Public Policy Forum, Rideau Hall Foundation, and the Michener Awards Foundation. The content reflects local perspectives and does not imply endorsement of any political party. Log on to altelection.ca, that's altelxn.ca, for more national coverage. I'm Daniel Messick with CICK News 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. Look us up at smithersradio.com.
There you have it. That's from Smithers Radio. Peter, you have some interesting results for us?
Yeah, this is another one to look at. So Carlton riding, and this is where Pierre Poilievre is running, and he's the incumbent. I mentioned earlier that the Liberal was leading. So they're now up to 40 polls reporting. The Liberal is leading. He is 1,500 votes ahead of Poilievre. So he's almost 54% of the vote. Poilievre is only at 43, and still very little happening with NDP, Green, or Independent. So that is definitely going to be one to watch. A question of whether Poilievre keeps his seat.
Yeah, I guess we kind of figured that would be a hard-fought battle. Peter, do you remember how many candidates actually ran in that riding?
90
candidates. So there you have it. Fairly interesting run. We're going to cut away to some local stations in a few seconds here. And when we come back, Jesse and Danny are going to join us again from Burnaby, BC. I want to remind you that you're listening to Alt Election Coverage 2025, part of the National Election Project, coordinated by NCRA NREC. This initiative is supported by the Covering Canada Election 25 Fund in participation with the Public Policy Forum, Rideau Hall Foundation, and the Michener Awards Foundation. We'd like to thank Barry Rook and Catherine Fisher as executive producer, our producer for the West Coast segment, Bailey, and we will come back in a few seconds with many other accolades, and Danny and Jesse in a few seconds. And it's over to Jesse and Danny.
Thanks again. Jesse Wenzloff, CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
And this is Danny Nezvedarani of CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Just continuing to keep a close eye on what's going on in the BC's southern coast, the mainland. Again, things looking pretty red, with just two ridings at this point in Greater Vancouver leaning NDP. That's Vancouver East, where Jenny Kwan is ahead by about 6% of the vote, and Vancouver Kingsway, where Don Davies has a 1.6% lead. So that one's still very much up in the air. In Burnaby Central, Jagmeet Singh's riding, he is currently in third place and very much looking like he is not going to win that riding. Wade Chang of the Liberals with 41.8% of the vote, James Yan of the Conservative Party with 36.6%, and Jagmeet Singh far behind at 20.4%. And Danny, how are things doing in New Westminster, Burnaby, Myardville?
New Westminster, Burnaby, it is still too early to tell, but at the moment, Jake Sawatsky is in the lead with about 0.2% of the vote.
Yeah, but it's 12 votes at this point.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. And trailing right behind is actually the Conservative candidate, Indy Ponchi. The incumbent, Peter Julian, is behind in third place, but again, these are pretty preliminary countings, so there will be a lot to see there. I think with Jake Sawatsky, one thing that really benefited him is that Mark Carney actually visited New West this campaign twice.
Twice, yeah.
In a month. And, you know, New West is not the biggest city. It is kind of the kind of place that if you're not from BC and you're talking to someone from New West, they'll just say they're from Vancouver. So the fact that, you know, the Liberal leader actually came and spent time in the city twice this campaign trail, I think most likely went a long way. And we'll see if that results in that riding flipping to the Liberals.
And that really goes along with what you're saying about seeing Jake Sawatsky at various campaign events, really just talking about sort of being a representative of Mark Carney and his party leader showing up to back him up for that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think a prevailing argument just being that if elected, I will have the more prominent voice within Parliament.
Great. Back to you in Sydney.
Yeah, thanks very much, gang. Quite interesting results from the Lower Mainland. Peter, before we go on, did you have something you wanted to note?
Things, you know, it's still early. Things are flipping back and forth in various places. A lot of Vancouver Island is now showing blue. I don't think too much more to say.
Okay. Next over, we have a Bailey coming back on to play us a clip.
So we have a clip from Prince George, BC, and this is an interview with Clay Putney, the former chief of Lhaide Tene First Nation, who's
running for Clay Tene.
Oh, sorry.
It's a strange. Yeah.
Thanks.
Clay Tene.
Oh, Clay Tene. Okay. Former chief of Clay Tene First Nation, who is running for the NDP in Prince George, Valmount Federal Riding.
On CFIS 93.1 in Prince George, BC, Rez Krebs sat down with former Clay Tene Chief Clay Poutney and talked about how the election could affect Indigenous people in the region.
I'm really interested in how you see the different parties kind of stacking up in terms of how they're addressing issues for First Nations people across this huge country. And I know like hundreds of First Nations, right?
Yeah. We're well over 600 different First Nations, and everybody has different needs. So that's, to me, is the biggest thing. For myself personally, with our First Nation, you know, the Liberals, there's different funding pots. And the Liberals haven't been terrible as a, you know, Canada. But that being said, like, we've gone through times with the Conservatives where they just chop funding as much as they can to First Nations, and we struggle, like, with, you know, water resources, things like that, because reserve lands are Canada.
They're federal.
They're federal. Federally jurisdiction. So you have to find dollars through federal pots to actually access and to better your community. So Like our community, forever, we have a big manganese deposit around that area. So they put us on, so our water has a bunch of manganese in it. It actually turns everything black. Like after a while, your toilets and your tubs and everything start turning black. but for the longest time, they said, you know, the federal levels at the time said we were just under what's acceptable. So they said, yeah, you guys, it's acceptable water. It's pretty good. And then I think about 5 years ago, that was actually when I was chief, they re-looked at the levels, and we were way above the level that was acceptable. So we've been working hard towards where we are getting a wastewater treatment plant, and we are looking at how to get fresh, like better water into the community. So we do have good people working on it. We do have, you know, our water guy comes out, Blake, and make sure that, you know, there's no bacteria to the UV and the filtering, right, to get to community. But that's one of the biggest things to me is just having the access to the pots of money. And everybody just thinks, oh, the First Nations just get money thrown at them. There's a huge process to get projects done on any reserve lands. It's, you know, feasibility studies. Do you have all your books in order? Your financial systems, are they good? Like, the government does not just give you dollars. They make sure that you have everything in place, so every penny is spent in a good way.
Yeah, extreme amount of scrutiny, hey?
Oh, so much scrutiny. And I get why it's there. It is needed. You just don't want to throw somebody $4 million and say, hey, build this thing. Yeah. You want to make sure that it's going to be built properly by the right people.
What about, you know, I assume that Clinton A is in some negotiations with both levels of government. I mean, I guess the question I'm getting to is, when you're in those kinds of negotiations, have you noticed a difference? Who's in power at the top level?
Definitely.
Really?
Definitely. If we have like the Liberal government, like minority with the NDP, helps out a lot. The Conservatives, pretty much, from what I remember, turn a blind eye. They're there and they say they claim that they're going to be helping, but since they chop funding, usually there's less people to do the work.
Right. Yep. Interesting.
Former Lake Tenet Chief Clay Poutney discussing the local Indigenous outlook on our federal election with Rez Krebs at CFIS 93.1 in Prince George.
Well, there you have it. That was thanks very much for that. We're just about to head back to the top of the hour, where we'll kick in with the second hour. Before we do that, Barry, do you want to introduce something you want to talk about at the start of the next hour segment?
Oh, there's a number of really close ridings that we're sort of still following here, specifically Kitchener, Conestoga in southwestern Ontario. We also see some really interesting information happening in the Bay of Quinte, where there's a hot riding going back and forth with only a couple of votes between them. We're still covering out in the Atlantic. There's been a bit more of a gap in Fraser's riding out there, but some really close things still to come. A few of these are probably not going to be called tonight, but we'll keep you updated as we move forward towards the top of the hour here. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Barry. And we'll go back into our backstage and see if we can't source a few folks that can give us a little more knowledge about what's going on in Central Canada, particularly if we're any closer to seeing if it's a majority or if we're going to have another Liberal minority. As you heard, a lot of the stations have called a Liberal government, but it was not specified whether it's going to be a majority or a minority. And I will say that Elizabeth May was just on, on one of the stations with probably a self-congratulatory session that she won.
Yeah, I think she made a speech.
She made a speech, yeah.